Just so everybody will kind of know what's going on, we call this meeting for 9 a.m. and it is about 9:03 now. The reason we're not starting is this is a seven-member committee and I like to start it with a quorum. We don't have one right now. Senator Corona is, as usual, punctual, responsible. It's much appreciated, much appreciated by the chair. There are two other senators somewhere in the building. We're trying to locate them now and get them here for roll call so that we can then begin. It's the chair's intention, just so people can kind of plan their day. If we finish by noon, great. If we don't, and we don't have to, it's the chair's intention to recess briefly for lunch. And by briefly, I don't mean 30 minutes. I mean like we'd probably recess until 1:15 and then come back and continue this afternoon with any more testimony that may be provided. So we'll stand sort of at ease for a few minutes, try to locate these other two senators if we can. Great. If we can't, we'll start without them in a few minutes anyway. Thanks.
Jack Rabbit.
Put in
Senate Committee on Jurisprudence will come to order. We don't yet have a quorum. We're still one short, but I'm told Senator Gallegos is en route from Houston, won't be here for about another half hour. So we're gonna begin with the three of us. We're hearing testimony on interim charges 1 and 2, and we'll be starting with charge 1. Are there any questions, Senator Harris or Senator Crone, any opening remarks y'all would like to make? Okay. Charge 1 is to examine and make recommendations relating to the jurisdiction of statutory county courts, including the development of standardized language for Chapter 25 of the Government Code, to confer specific types of jurisdiction on statutory county courts, and to ensure the statutes are clear and concise. We have, as a panel, and I'd call forward to the desk at the front, please, Judge Rusty Ladd, Judge Alfonso Charles, Judge Lamar McCorkle, and Bob Wessels. If y'all could come forward, and I've got witness cards from the four of y'all. Anybody else that would like to testify today on this or any other charge, if you'd fill out one of these witness cards, you have blank witness cards, and then I think they're blank witness cards in the rear. If you'll just bring them up to the clerk, that'd be helpful. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Senator.
Who's going to start out?
Probably I will, sir.
Okay. If each of you just identify yourself and who you represent before you begin your testimony, we'll proceed.
Very well. My name is Judge Rusty Ladd. I'm from Lubbock County, here on behalf of the County Courts of Law Association. As folks here are probably aware, the Judicial Council was determined to explore the jurisdictional quagmire or dilemma, however you want to put it, regarding statutory county courts of law. A committee was formed that Judge Charles and I, at least, were a member of, and the resolution that is before, I think, you guys from the Judicial Council is a result of the work that we did and recommended to the Judicial Council. And I think it very accurately reflects the dilemma that sort of exists between the massive and probably very impractical work it would be to overhaul county courts as a system. Let's county courts at law that exist now retain the jurisdiction they have, and that can be as far-ranging as almost district court jurisdiction to one like mine, which is a very limited jurisdiction, while at the same time providing statutory relief and uniformity for any new county courts at law that might be created. That's a very short and succinct way, I think, to put the resolutions that are before you.
Thank you. Any questions of the witness? Apparently not. Yes, sir.
I'm Judge Alfonso Charles from Gregg County, and I was also on the committee. And one other thing.
I'm sorry, sir. Which county?
Gregg County, Longview, Texas. Okay. And one of the other things, too, that this would do is, with a proposal from the committee, attempt to clean up a lot of the language that already exists that's confusing in Chapter 25. And try and get some standard uniform language for several of the jurisdictions. And our hopes in talking with several of the other counties that are in county courts law would be that they would also use this as an opportunity to kind of clean up some of the languages that exist in their counties and try and make as much as possible the general language for county courts at law more uniform while still allowing, you know, counties that wanted to remain the same with their current jurisdictions, either if it be, you know, like mine is almost unlimited on both criminal and civil, or, you know, stay the same on, you know, if they're at a $100,000 cap on civil right now. But we're also the attempt would be to try and clean up as much of that language, like especially on the family law section where there's so many different varieties of the way family law is described, mm-hmm. to try and clean up as much as possible on that type of language too.
Thank you. Any questions? Next.
My name is Lamar McCorkle. I am actually sitting in for Chief Justice Linda Thomas, who is the chair of the committee that reviewed this. She is in Dallas, not feeling well today, and asked if I would step in because I've been working with it as well. I'm in Harris County. I'm a district judge. I think that the critical issue I could bring to this is that the county court judges throughout the state have worked on this, and the document that's being presented or the proposal that's being presented is a consensus document as far as a proposal goes, and all judges all across the state have worked on it in one way or another.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Bob Wessels, I'm the court manager for the county courts in Harris County. Here is a resource, and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Got any questions, Senator Harris? Got any questions?
Not yet, Mr. Chairman.
All right. All right. Thank all four of you. Appreciate your being here very much. Chair calls Sally Emerson. Morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Let me just...
Senator Harris?
You county court judges who have jurisdiction over family law, do you all also have associate judges that hear the cases first on temporary?
Yes, sir. On temporary orders, there's often...
I hate to ask you to do this, but if you'd come back to the mic so we're recording all this.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
There's often an associate judge, Senator, that will hear temporary orders before the case gets to us. In a statutory county court like mine or Judge Charles that has family law jurisdiction that's practically the same as the district courts, then we have the same resources as far as availability of a court master or an associate judge to hear temporary orders.
In the smaller counties like Gregg County, we're not going to have that. We'll start out with the temporary orders, and the only thing, we'll have the court master for the AG child support cases, but other than that, we'll take it from the beginning.
You'll have 4D master?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you have associate judges at the district court level in Gregg County?
No, we do not.
Do not. And how about...
In Lubbock County, we do, sir. Yes, sir.
That's because the law school's there.
Could be a possibility.
Do most of the cases go to the county courts up there in Lubbock?
I'm sorry, sir?
Do most of the family law cases go to the county court, or do they go to the district court out in Lubbock County?
It is evenly distributed. There are 6 district courts in Lubbock and 3 county court at law. So whenever a new case is filed in a family law case, then it falls in line with one of the 9 courts. So I have a 1/9 of the cases that get filed.
All right. So then you don't have your district courts out there divided up into, say, only civil litigation, only family law, only criminal?
We don't have, as a matter of statute. Several years ago, Lubbock County judges at both levels, statutory county court and district court, formed a gentleman's agreement, if you will, amongst themselves so that, for example, there are 2 county courts at law that handle criminal and family. There's 1 county court at law that handles non-family civil cases and family. And no one was really wanting to take on all the family law cases. And the district courts have a similar arrangement.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Ms. Emerson.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman.
No,
I got
okay.
Delayed reaction.
Yep. It's okay.
Not enough coffee yet.
Early in the morning. Welcome again to the committee.
Thank you again. Chairman Wentworth and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to speak to you today on behalf of the Texas Family Law Foundation. My name is Sally Emerson. I'm a family law attorney from Amarillo, which is in Senator Seliger's district, not too far from Senator Duncan's district, which my law firm actually has an office in Lubbock, and I went to Tech Law School and undergraduate there too. So,
what a great law school.
Pardon?
What a great law school.
It is. It's a fabulous
law
school.
And you live in Potter County?
Yeah, for those who couldn't get Baylor.
I actually reside in Potter County, the northern part of Amarillo. Under current law, whether a statutory county court has jurisdiction in family law cases depends on the county in which the court's located. As a statewide organization, the Texas Family Law Foundation favors retaining the current method of the legislature granting jurisdiction to family law cases to statutory county courts on a county-by-county basis. We do not advocate granting all statutory county courts family law jurisdiction, nor do we advocate removing family law jurisdiction from those statutory county courts that currently have that jurisdiction. we feel that legislators and their constituents in each area of the state, including the family lawyers in each area, know what is best in any given area. And we will defer to the judgment of our members as to whether statutory county courts in a given county ought to have family law jurisdiction. And we understand the committee is considering a better way of defining cases that are family law, family cases and proceedings, which is the phrase used in Chapter 25 of the Government Code to grant family law jurisdiction to statutory county courts. And we support any effort by the legislature to clarify which cases are to be brought in which courts. While we have not seen any language upon which we can express an opinion at this time, we pledge to stay actively involved with your committee's work and your staff to develop the best approach to achieve that goal. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate taking just a minute to express on behalf of Texas Family Lawyers our apologies for not being actively involved in the legislative process in the past, as we should have been. And you may be aware that many Texas family lawyers have concerns about measures that have been passed recently by the legislature and other issues that you're sure to be asked about or asked to consider in the next legislative session. The decisions you make affect Texas families, and those are our clients, and we have been remiss in not speaking up on their behalf in the past. We intend to change that. Some of us have been grumbling lately, but we have no one to blame. We admit we have no one to blame but ourselves because we've sat on the sidelines, and we haven't come and testified in your committees. And to be honest, a lot of us were not even aware that some of the various bills were being considered until they were passed and made law. So the leadership of the Texas Family Law Foundation has decided that we are going to be active, we're going to be in the game from here on out, year in and year out, to give you perspective of those who actually represent Texas families every day. So toward that end, we have hired professional representation to work with you and your staff, and we are putting into place resources to communicate with and mobilize our members so that you will have the best thinking on the important issues that you consider that will affect Texas families. And because your charge is limited to review of the jurisdiction of the statutory county courts, I'm not going to go into our agenda today, but I want you to know that we will be contacting the committee and their staff soon to lay out our agenda, and we hope to become well acquainted with each of you. And I'd also like to announce, Mr. Chairman, that the Texas Family Law Foundation is going to be actively working with other segments of the legal profession on issues of joint concern, such as protecting the right to a jury trial and keeping Texas courts open and seeing that our judicial system has the resources needed to do its job effectively. And I'd like to thank you again for allowing us to address you today, and we look forward to working with
you. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Harris.
Now, up to now and for years, and I've wondered where the family bar has been since my law partner and I practiced predominantly family law. Y'all have left it up to Harry Tindall and Jack Sampson, and in turn they've been able to do certain things to justify their seminars and their rewrites, and everybody goes down and takes their classes after the session. Now, you say, if I'm kind of reading you right now, what you've been saying, the inference is there that there are some of you within, or a majority of you within the family bar, that what they advocated and we passed in the name of the family bar was not what the family bar wanted. Is that what I'm understanding?
I believe you're understanding that correctly.
All right. Now, you're saying that you want to leave it court by court, county court by county court basis as far as which statutory county courts hear family law. We had a situation years ago in Tarrant County where we had a statutory county court judge that every time a condemnation case got to him, he instructed, openly instructed the jury to enter their vote, cast their vote for the people who were doing the condemning. We came in, or the legislature came in and took away original jurisdiction from that judge and put it with district court. And I'm kind of wondering what are you in essence telling us that you think some of the county court judges out there are incompetent to hear family law, or why is it you do not want it to be straight across the board where all statutory county courts can have original jurisdiction over family law cases?
Well, I can give you a perfect example. I practice up in the Panhandle. Several of the counties up there have statutory county courts that handle family law, and several of them have statutory county courts that do not. It works on a county-to-county basis, I believe, because in each county, it seems like that particular county is able to determine how much is needed, what the case flow is, whether or not that county court at law needs to be hearing family court or needs to have family law jurisdiction. In Potter County, we have one county court at law that does have family law jurisdiction, and we have one county court at law that does not have family law jurisdiction. And the judges, it's kind of like Judge Ladd was talking, the judges have gentleman agreements between the district and the county, and that one county court at law as to the percentage that each takes, and the case laws, the case flow is fine. On the southern part of Amarillo, Randall County, we have a brand new county court at law, a statutory county court at law. It's the number two. We've had one for years and years, one statutory county court at law with family law jurisdiction. He has pretty much acted almost as an associate judge down in Canyon because he has heard all the family law temporary matters. Then for the final matter, we have to go to the district judge. So that they're in the process right now of getting that all straightened out with this second statutory county court at law that's going to have family law jurisdiction. Now it's going to ease the case flow, and it's going to make it a lot better for us because the same judge that hears temporary is going to probably hear the final. So I just give you those two examples as an example that on a county-to-county basis, it seems like if you left it on a county-to-county basis where each county and the constituents of each county and their judicial group is able to determine that, I think that's going to be better than just a broad base. Here's
all
how it's
right,
going
let's
to
say
be.
We come in and we go ahead and standardize the county courts as to their jurisdiction, and in particular as to the jurisdiction relating to family law. It will still be up to the locals as to how they want to portion that out, will it not?
I'm sure it will be.
And that way, all of them have, each county has that tool available to them. I mean, you don't even want that tool to be made available, if I'm understanding you correctly.
Well,
courts other than those that currently have it.
Well, let me just tell you that I have well seen judges who have jurisdiction, family law jurisdiction, who do not like family law cases, do not want to handle family law cases, and to force them and say, well, now you've got the jurisdiction. I know one of our judges doesn't have family law jurisdiction. He doesn't want it. And I don't really think it's fair for a judge who honestly does not want it to say you have to have family law cases.
Maybe he shouldn't be running for judge.
Exactly. But, you know, so the problem is there's a lot of them on the bench right now like that. That are already there that may be there for four more years, but I just don't know that putting a broad base will correct it. Now, we have members in all counties across the state, and I'm just speaking for what I believe our members on a county-to-county basis would like to probably say that they would like to keep it as a county-to-county basis.
Who is going to be working with the members of the legislature at the direction of the Family Law Council? You mentioned that you have hired people to interface with the members. Who will those, more or less, who can I expect to be calling on me as to how you all want changes or don't want changes in the family law code?
Well, Steve Bresnan is who I expect to be the one that will be contacting you. He's the one that we are working with, the Family Law Foundation.
Steve Bresnan does not even know what a waiver is. Waiver citation.
Well, he got me here today, so he pointed me in the right direction. So.
What, you mean I'm going to have to be teaching him?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Senator Gallegos.
Ms. Emerson, let me ask you, and I've read your testimony here. I guess what my concern is, I don't know what goes on in Amarillo, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't. I know what goes on in Harris County in Houston, Texas, but as far as these family court fights and, you know, who you pick, who you don't want to pick, what judge is interested, what judge is not interested, see, you know, I'm not there. I don't know what the judge is, who is. I am in Harris County, and in some of these cases, you know, I've been in the past, I'm not a lawyer. but I see when, you know, a judge picks a certain lawyer to be ad litem or guarantor or call it what you want, where funds are basically drained out of an estate that basically has a minimum, and all of a sudden at the end of the case there are no funds.
Now that's a different charge.
It is?
Yeah, we've got two charges.
I was going to say, I hope you're not going to ask me a probate question because I really don't know anything about that area.
Well.
We'll be getting that in
just a few minutes.
We're not on the charge.
No, we're not on that charge yet.
Well, excuse me. Well, then I'll yell at the one that's in charge of that.
Good, you can let me off the hook.
Now that we've got a quorum, are you through?
Yes.
Let me ask the clerk to call the roll since we know we're going to have a quorum.
Senator Wentworth?
Here.
Senator Gallegos?
Here.
Senator Corona?
Here.
Senator Duncan? Senator Harris?
Here.
Senator Hinojosa? Senator West?
Quorum is present. Members, you've got in your books a copy of the minutes of the last meeting, which was held August 24th. Have a motion to approve the minutes. Senator Harris moves to approve the minutes as printed. Any objection? Without objection, the minutes are approved. All right, Ms. Emerson, thank you very much for your
testimony. Thank you for having me. I
appreciate
you
being here.
Thank you.
Chair calls Susan Norman.
She looks familiar.
Good morning.
Morning.
Related to charge one, I am.
Please do say who you are and who you represent.
I am an attorney from Houston. I represent a gentleman named Perry Lee Watley.
And your name is?
Susan Norman.
Okay.
Related to charge one, limited to the portion of Chapter 25 of the Government Code, which goes to recusals. Chapter 25 of the Government Code provides that recusal issues, which are normally handled under Chapter 18 and chapters of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, for the statutory probate courts, recusals are handled by assigning by Judge Herman, or the statutory providing judge, assigns a judge to hear a recusal filed against another statutory probate court by a litigant. Currently, that Chapter 25 restricts the body of available judges to one of the 17 statutory probate judges. We have a very small group who is sitting upon its own members and generally not recusing no matter what the issue is. There's a remedy for that, and it's to include the probate judges in Chapter 74 of the Government Code. Under Chapter 74, the presiding judge of the region, whatever region the probate court is in, not the probate judge in that area.
Talking about the district court judge.
Any judge. The presiding administrative judge of a region,
yeah,
should be able to assign a judge who is out
is
of
county.
Is that
not normally a district judge?
It could be a district judge. It could be a county court at law judge. It's any judge. Right now, it's currently restricted to the 17 statutory probate court judges. We've had massive abuses with that issue in Harris County. And there has to be a remedy. So to the extent that charge one deals with Chapter 25 of the Government Code, we're here to say, take the language out of chapter, take the focus out of Chapter 25 and put it back in Chapter 74. Because it's the abuses in Harris County. In my particular client's case, we've had a mandamus filed. We've had multiple mandamuses filed. No judge, the presiding judge over my client's case, has never been recused, even though he's constitutionally disqualified. He has been found to have no jurisdiction to enter any orders since September 9th of last year, and yet he's entering orders, and the judges hearing his cases are not disqualifying him. He's not being recused. It is a massive problem, but it's because Chapter 25 of the Government Code is being used. That's where the statutory authority is. It needs to be moved to Chapter 74.
Now, Ms. Norman, when you say we're here to urge this change, who exactly do you have in mind when you say we?
I'm here for my client, Perry Watley. He's not here. He cannot be here. His wife. I believe there are other people here. I believe Michael Epstein, David Wukeson are here. I'm here for my client, but there are other people here who I believe have the same interest in that, in this issue.
Thank you. Are there questions of the witness? If not, thank you for appearing, Ms. Norman. Appreciate your being here. Are there others who want to testify on charge number one, interim charge number one? If not, we'll go to charge two, which is to examine and make recommendations to improve court oversight of fiduciaries appointed to make financial and personal decisions for wards, as well as those appointed to administer an estate or trust. And is he going to be a panel or not? We'll call Judge Guy Herman.
Good morning.
Welcome.
I'm Guy Herman. I'm probate judge here in Travis County. I'm also the presiding statutory probate judge for the state of Texas, selected by my peers for a four-year term. This is my second term. I was not the last 4 years, but the 4 years before I was presiding judge. And I have a handout I would like to,
Jeff, you give it to
pass around. Let me
have one. Mr. Chairman, has his hair gotten longer?
Mr. Harris, I believe it has.
Yeah. Uh-oh, I just got a haircut.
It kind of got a red face.
Well, I've been going to a few football games sitting out in the sun. I want to talk just briefly, because there was something just mentioned about recusal. You have before you a document that shows you that this so-called, this Watley case, and we'll call it the Watley case, that rather than the courts being abusive in the litigation, you will find, if you'll look just on the left side, this is a case of guardianship, to create a guardianship over Perry Watley. Now, I don't know the merits of whether or not Perry Watley needs a guardian, but I do know that every time I've been in court on a recusal hearing, Mr. Watley has never been there. I do know, as the judge who, presiding judge who hears some recusals, that Mr. Watley has an ad litem who has been against any recusal motions being filed on behalf of his client. And I do know that that person, Mr. Watley, there's some evidence in the record that he is incapacitated, has no ability to hire a lawyer such as Ms. Norman.
I'm Mr. Chairman.
Suggest it, Ms. Norman.
Here. Hold it, Judge, please. Mr. Chairman, I really raise a question as to the relevance of going into this. I mean, do we want to go back and retry an individual case, or do we want to look overall at the problems? This is kind of a swearing match between parties.
Well, clearly we're not here to try anything, but I do think we're here to listen to the testimony given, and since this case has been raised by another witness, if you could just sort of succinctly.
Well, I'll relate it back to the, one of the issues is that people have complained, and some people on this witness list have complained about the high cost of litigation. And I can tell you, you will have high cost of litigation when you have seven removals to the federal court of a guardianship case, all of which have been remanded, and finally the federal court entering an order telling the persons attempting to move that case into federal court that don't come over here again unless you have our permission first. You have had, if you look through that document, you'll see untold numbers of recusals that Harris County, not only is there litigation costs, they've had to pay for old judge to come over there and hear the recusals. And I will also apprise you that in every, we've got Mr. Alpert, we've got Mr. Epstein, we got the Watley person here now, and there's another case that came out of Harris County in my earlier tenure called the Conte case. And I've gone back, and I'll give this document to you, but it shows that in Mr. Epstein's case that there have been either appeals or mandamuses five different times, and each and every time the Court of Appeals has upheld the trial court. In Mr. Alpert's case, he recently did win on 831 a reversal of a summary judgment ruling by the court on whether or not a court-appointed fiduciary had judicial immunity. There's a divergence in the courts of appeals as to whether that's case. In San Antonio Court of Appeals, they say that a fiduciary does have judicial immunity, of the receive, a receiver. In Harris County, they've now ruled that you don't. And that's the law, evidently, in Harris County, is that you don't. But those kind of cases, when you have appeals, but if I go back and look at other appeals, there was an appeal dismissed for nonpayment of fees, but someone had to respond to that appeal. Someone had to bring that to their attention. You go back, three mandamuses in the Alpert case, all denied by the Court of Appeals.
Okay,
you
Judge,
go to Conte,
Judge,
same thing, over and over,
I
and I'll hand
I really
to
am going to suggest now. Let me reread charge two. And we want, the committee is truly interested in your comments, but the charge is that we're responsible for responding to, examine and make recommendations to improve court oversight of fiduciaries appointed to make financial and personal decisions for wards, as well as those appointed to administer an estate or trust. And thus far, as Senator Harris pointed out, you're responding to
lawyer
on specific cases. Okay. We'd like your recommendations on ways to improve the system as it currently exists.
One thing that I would do, and I think this is a problem area, is make it clear that when a court awards additional compensation, we have a statutory scheme is that a guardian is entitled to 5% of the in and 5% of the out, 5% of the income, 5% of the payments made out. That's our compensation scheme here in the state of Texas. We've had that for a long period of time. There is a problem area when that calculation is unreasonably low. A person is entitled to come before the court and ask for an additional compensation. And I think that raises some potential problems, because one of the problems is there on occasion a court may appoint a lawyer or a CPA as a guardian or as court administrator, and there's two different kinds of expenses of an administrator. One is the compensation earned by the administrator. In every case, you have the five in, five out, or a guardian, five in and five out, unless they waive it. Then you have the expenses for administration, the attorney's fees. And those two expenses are out there in every case. If I appointed your assistant over here as administrator, and then she hired a lawyer, she would be entitled to get 5% in, 5% out, plus her attorney's fees that she paid. If she felt the 5% in and out was unreasonably low, she has the right to approach the court and get some additional compensation. And that, I think, lies the problem, because there have been some courts and there are lawyers who feel that if a lawyer or a CPA or some other professional is appointed guardian and the 5% in and out is unreasonably low, that they ought to be compensated, and they look at the compensation by saying, well, what does the CPA make normally in an hourly rate, or what does this lawyer make normally as an hourly rate, and then we'll compensate them for their duties in an hourly rate that I don't think is appropriate. Okay, that's one area problem.
You think it's too high or too low?
It can be too high, and what we tried to do, I think in 2003, it may have been 2001, is to say the court shouldn't do that, but what the legislature came up with, and this was not a bill that started early, it was a bill that got added in, it says that the court couldn't, in determining whether or not a compensation is unreasonably low, the court couldn't just solely look at what that professional made as an hourly rate. Well, that's one thing to say in making the determination whether the five in and five out is unreasonably low, you don't look at that, but then it doesn't tell you how do we decide what that compensation, extra compensation is. And I have a proposal that I would like to have handed out to the committee. And it essentially it reformats that statute, and it changes it, and it says that we keep pretty much the same language in terms of making the determination. You don't just look at what that person, if they were a lawyer, would have made. That's not the sole determining factor. But it can be a factor. But when you make the compensation, you look, number one, at an itemized bill of their hours. It has to be verified and sworn. And then, while the court may hold a hearing at any point in time, your court has to hold a hearing if the additional compensation sought exceeds $5,000. And I think that would resolve some of the problem that we have in that compensation. The other area that is a problem, and it's addressed in the backside expenses allowed. And that is when a lawyer asks for their fees through the guardian and over to the court. I have seen, and I have seen lawyers do this, and I have tried to the best of my ability to be diligent in not allowing it to happen, is that a lawyer may perform some of the duties that the guardian would perform, either because the guardian doesn't want to perform them, or they may be the guardian themselves or the administrator, and they want, in legal fees, they're asking for money at an hourly rate of $225 or $250 an hour, $200 an hour, to go to the bank to deposit the checks that came in from the income of the guardianship. Okay, I don't think they ought to be paid their hourly rate in that context. We have rules in my court. Mm-hmm. We have rules, and we publish it, put it up on the webpage, that we're not doing that. And I think that other courts, because I've talked to judges, to realize when you pay attorney's fees that you can only pay for legal service fees, and you're not to be paying for somebody to go over and visit his ward. You don't pay somebody $250 an hour to go visit their ward. That's part of guardianship compensation. Now, I have a policy, and it's a policy that I don't, in the normal situation, I will not allow a court-appointed fiduciary. If I appoint you as guardian, you can hire yourself as lawyer, but I don't allow the lawyer then to ask for attorney's fees as their expenses and then compensation, although the statute would allow that, and there's been some court cases that say that. And some people have complained about, why should a court-appointed fiduciary, a lawyer, get lawyer's fees? Why don't they just take the compensation? The law is that, you know, every guardianship is born with the burden of attorney's fees and compensation. And if the fiduciary, lawyer appointed fiduciary, or CPA says, I want my, let's use the lawyer example, I want my legal fees, and they're legitimate legal fees, he ought to be paid those. And if they waive or don't ask for any compensation, then that's to the benefit of the guardianship. So what I've done on the 666 expenses allowed is just add a new section, 667, and one, I put in B in 666 on the second page, is saying, in calculating that, the court shall award fees only for the performance of legal services. I think that's what the law is, but if we need to clarify it and put it in the statute, let's do it. Second part, on the expense account, it already, I think, is set out that it shall be in writing, shall be verified by affidavit, filed with the clerk. And, you know, it wouldn't bother me if we put expenses allowed under C, if we wanted to say that, and it's a rule in our court, if there's going to be $5,000 worth of attorney's fees, you've got to come to court and hold a hearing and prove up your attorney's fees. But there's various ways of doing that. But that's one of the issues that I have heard, and I've seen some cases that there's been unhappiness that the person is taking a legal fee rather than a compensation. I think, you know, the person takes a legal fee in lieu of the compensation, as long as he's paid for legal.